Good evening, James McCanny. I do apologize for last week. This is my science hour, and I was just out of energy last week, so I called into the networks, and I'm hearing some background noise on the... Okay, there we are online now. I was just out of energy last week. I had a very busy week presenting scientific material to a large group of scientists. And about the close to the end of the day on Thursday, let's say I was just out of energy. So I called at both networks and had them rerun a show from prior weeks. And so I rarely do that, but sometimes I just have to take care of myself. So I apologize for that. Also, I want to welcome new listeners from a number of new countries, in the world. This show, of course, is heard worldwide, but a few new fellow listeners in Russia, also in some of the Western states, and so welcome new listeners. This, the main science topic for tonight, I'm going to talk about the presentation I gave this past week at an international scientific conference. And so that will be a number of main issues dealing with Earth weather, electrical conditions in the solar system, and some basic understanding of how all of this works. But first, a little bit of commentary. I have to catch up from a couple weeks of activity. Of course, we had the Memorial Day storm activity. And now, actually right now as I am sitting here, I'm looking at one of the screens that has a major storm moving into the Mideast right now. It's not certain where it will hit, whether it will be Iraq or Iran and or Kuwait, but this is a major storm moving into that region at this time. There's another major storm that's already has landfall in eastern India, off of the Indian Ocean, and also a storm that looks like it just came off of Burma, that and Thailand, with another storm moving into China right now, an extreme set of storms moving through the Midwest right now. It looks like it's mainly centered over Iowa at this very moment. And moving very rapidly. All of these storms are developing, moving very rapidly, which is indicative of high active solar electrical conditions. Exactly the topic I'm going to talk about tonight, the main science topic. And then also, as you may remember, last usually at the beginning of the year, so last January or February, I made my annual predictions of severe weather, and of course I picked June 6th as one of the time frames, actually June 3rd to June 6th as one of the time frames for severe weather. And that is due to inferior conjunction of Mercury, which is occurring right now. I just pulled up the satellite views, and Mercury is moving quickly, as it always does, the fleet-footed planet, as they used to call it in old mythology, moving between Earth and the Sun, and that's going to actually happen tomorrow on June 6th, but at this point, it connects, makes a very good electrical connection between the Sun and Earth. The new moon was on June 3rd, and so that makes any time after the 3rd of June up to the 5th and 6th, a prime time for triggering major Earth storms. Right now, as of a few hours ago, we did not have any new storms in the Caribbean or the Atlantic hurricane region, but I noticed that there are some major storms rolling off the west coast of Africa, that lip of Africa where the storms form, and then as they drive out over the Atlantic, become hurricanes. There's some of those storms forming right now. And we do have a storm that's beginning to rotate out off of the Caribbean, just northeast of Cuba. Actually, north right now, north of Puerto Rico. So all of these storms, plus there's a fairly significant storm that hasn't quite formed yet. It looks like it's trying to form off the eastern seaboard just south and east of Maine. Plus, as I said, the major storm system, very visible on the worldwide map of the storm system over the Midwest, primarily centered over Iowa. So, in fact, I was in that storm today, and the lightning bolts were coming down 2-3 miles from the sky. You could see them hitting, and I know there were some houses that were in that caught on fire due to that lightning. And that's the kind of thing we're seeing a little bit more of Indiana. There were some gas storage tanks that were ignited and blew up due to lightning. This is the kind of thing we're seeing in... So the sun is becoming more active, plus we're in this June 6th time period. And I want to get back to the Memorial Day weekend storms and what the cause of that was. In fact, that was going to be one of the main topics of my show last week. And, of course, that I did not have a chance to really give a good detailed explanation of that. So anyway, let's go back to Memorial Day weekend. And actually, on May 23rd, which I believe was a Friday, yes, May 23rd was Friday, a comet, actually have a name, the type of comets that come from the south, and they are believed by astronomers to be a remnants of a broken-up comet that happened thousands of years ago. Because of the region of the sky they come in from, they're coming in from the south. But actually what's going on is these are streamers of large objects and small objects, a whole range of size of objects that are coming in from the southern region of the solar system, and typically are sun grazers. And this one in particular crashed into the surface of the sun, causing a large CME. And, of course, when you read the literature on the scientific websites, it is very emphatic. Whether you read spaceweather.com or the SOHO webpage or the STEREO, which is a satellite, the twin satellites observing the sun, they always state emphatically that this comet could not possibly have caused it. It was simply coincidence that a comet happened to be in a place where solar flare and CME occurred, CME being a coronal mass ejection where literally the entire surface of the sun lifts off and blasts out into space. But in fact, as you know from listening to this show, comets are not dirty snowballs, and the idea that all of these comets are coming in from the south is indicative of a large object or series of objects that come in from that direction, something we sometimes call Planet X. So this is a series of objects that trail in that orbit because of the long-standing orbit. And by the way, there's a lot of information. A lot of people say there's a 3,600-year orbit, and that actually couldn't possibly be true because if it were a 3,600-year orbit, the object would already have been here and passed by now. So, as I've said before, the orbit has to be much longer, and if there is such an object, and the Kreutz comets that come from the south are very much an indicator that there is such an object that comes through the solar system. But back to May 23rd, when a significant piece of chunk of matter came in, formed a comet, the plasma discharge comet model, of course, explaining how this would discharge to the solar surface. And, of course, you have to understand that the solar fusion is at the surface of the sun, and that's why a comet that is an electrical discharge can come near the sun and ignite it like a spark plug, causing a large solar flare. So no mystery there. But the issue was that about 3 days later, on the 26th, is when that flare passed Earth and, in fact, ignited the severe weather that we saw on Memorial Day. So there was a direct connection between a comet igniting a CME at the sun, driving weather systems on Earth 3 days later. All very much explainable. Timing, the solar wind patterns, etc., all being very much explainable, and igniting the weather systems on Memorial Day weekend. And of course, the entire country was engulfed in tornadoes. I read an article just now where in the past, this is as of June 1st, there were 167 tornadoes that they believe occurred during that time frame in just a couple days. 167 tornadoes, more tornadoes than typically occur in the entire year up to that point in time. And of course, early in February, there were some significant tornadic activity also. So this year is off the charts in terms of severe weather, tornadoes, and so it makes one wonder if we are seeing some manipulated weather going on. And I've talked about that before, that the toys that are being used to manipulate weather are laser satellites. You beam a satellite down through the ionosphere to ground. It ignites a path. It breaks down the dielectric of the atmosphere and basically enhances storm activity. It doesn't create storm activity. The laser does not provide the energy. It simply triggers existing energy in the atmosphere and enhances storm systems. And also, I'll be talking in a minute about the Myanmar cyclone, the one that devastated Burma this past month. I'm going to be talking about that also in terms of possibility of manipulated storms. And I've mentioned that before, but since that has now passed, I want to go through some of the details of that, some of the very unusual details, which very much point to me that that was a man-made created storm, and why it was created to devastate that small fledgling country. So at any rate, I'm just going to make a general comment, because I know there are many scientists, professional scientists, who listen to this show. And of course, I have categories that I've listed of scientists: tier 1, tier 2, tier 3. And the tier 1 scientists typically are scientists that you never hear about. You never hear their names. You never see them in public. And these are the scientists, probably the most realistic scientists. They follow my work very closely. They're very familiar with me and my work. And they come out of the woodwork quite regularly to talk to me and deal with scientific issues. Then there's the Tier 2 scientists, the ones that you typically would think from Goddard, NASA, JPL, etc., that are what you would typically think of as the leading scientists in the field today, and many times you do see their name in public. Then there's the Tier 3 scientists, what I call these are people who have gotten degrees in science, astronomy, or whatever, and teach in colleges, but don't do any real research. And, basically teach what they're told to teach in schools, whether it's college or outreach programs or filtering it down to the high school level, etc. So, and then it goes on. But what I want to mention is that science, even at the tier one level, is struggling for understanding. So I know a lot of these people listen to this show and follow my work as far as understanding the overall energetic system that we live in the solar system. And that's, once again, was one of the issues I was dealing with this past week, when I attended a scientific, large scientific meeting to coordinate information with other scientists, something I do regularly. So, let's go back to just finish off the Memorial Day weekend. Once again, now this was what I call a himmicane. It came off the Pacific as a rotating storm. Nothing unusual, but when it hit California, it became clear that this was not a normal storm. It formed a complete hurricane system over land, what I call a himmicane, a term I coined in my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the physics of sun-earth weather. And so a himmicane is basically a hurricane over land. There was a tremendous snowstorm in California and Oregon up the west coast. And that was the first indication that this was a storm that was going to cause a lot of damage. It moved through the Colorado, the western states, Wyoming, Colorado, Montana. And then it extended out, and it had all of the markings of a hurricane, the band clouds, the tornadoes on the leading edge, and these swept across the entire United States from Texas to Canada. An immense storm, and this is the storm that was driven by the CME that came past Earth on the 26th of May. So once again, the Memorial Day storm, very much attributable to the comet that came by the sun on May 23rd. Now let's go back and review some of the main points, and some of these will be political issues, but just look at the conditions that occurred during that storm, the cyclone that devastated the small country, the independent states of Myanmar, otherwise known as Burma. Now this is a peninsula that sticks down south of Thailand, in just north of Australia, of course, and geographically. The storm came in from the west. Now, if you've been watching, or if you understand how storm systems move in that area, as I've watched for years and years and years, the storms move towards the west. They don't move in an easterly direction. This storm spun off of the main westerly moving equatorial storm belt and moved east, coming up from the western side, hitting Burma. And the path now was most interesting. As it came ashore, it went directly over four major cities in that country. But these cities are not in a line. That storm had to move, and it was much like the manipulation that occurred with Storm Katrina as it moved through the New Orleans area. Remember that Katrina came across the southern tip of Florida, moved westerly. As it got about 100 and or about 200 miles south of New Orleans, it turned due north, came up, went across and went slightly east of, actually east of New Orleans, the eye did, and it made a direct hit over some of the major refineries. And that'll be something I'll be commenting on also, because they're already moving up gas prices based on speculation that there will be hurricanes this year. It's one of the factors. Now, I'll get into that in just a little while here. But let's look at the situation in Myanmar, looking in retrospect, the cyclonic storm that devastated that country. No question in my mind that this was a manipulated storm. The storm came in from the west and hit four major cities. This occurred on the day of the national election to develop a free, independent country, and one of the stipulations in that was to have a free banking system in the country. In other words, the European bankers were not getting their way. So the end result was a clear political reason for that storm to be driven in and disrupt that country. And then immediately, the Bush, who are the front people, the CIA people who are the police force for the world bankers, the Bush administration wanted to go in there and give aid. But $3.2 million worth of aid, about a dollar per person, not enough to do anything, but they had the naval ships sitting offshore. They had the UN troops ready to go in there, and the leaders of that country said, no, do not come ashore. that they would consider it an invasion, and the leaders of that country who were newly elected made it very clear that they did not want the U.S. or the U.N. there. And as I've said before, this is not new. This is becoming more commonplace after, for example, the tsunami that devastated India. The government of India told the United States Navy, do not come ashore, because once they park there, they just don't seem to want to leave, if you understand what I mean. And the implication being that they would stay there to form a new government based on Western banking principles. Bring them democracy, if you know what I mean. So at any rate, that is the end result, and the poor country is caught between a rock and a hard spot. And then I just want to add that about 3 days later, another storm formed coming in from the easterly direction, and that storm looked like another manipulated storm, but then dissipated as it became clear that the country was not going to allow Western military or the UN in there. So, at any rate, on to a couple other quick comments. I already talked about the June 6th predictions, and those are once again coming out exactly on time. The weather, with the new moon triggering, the new moon passing, I should say, triggering the storm systems that we are now seeing around the world, including the United States, a very large storm system currently moving through central United States. I'm going to divert the topic here for 1 second. There was an excellent presentation that I attended during the scientific meeting, and I'll just give a quick analysis or a summary. And this is dealing with small-scale nuclear war, and the fact that a small-scale nuclear war is not something that's going to benefit anyone. We've had, for example, the Clintons mentioning that if Iran does anything, they're going to wipe them off the face of the earth with nuclear weapons. Now, the point of this talk was that this is a bad idea, because what's going to happen is the superheated, say you bombed Tehran, for example, with all of the buildings and the material there, that would catch on fire. A superheated storm along with the nuclear blast would raise this material up into the very high in the atmosphere. This is unlike other fires. For example, a large-scale forest fire, the soot and ash goes up, and even some major volcanic eruptions, the soot and ash goes up a certain level. But with nuclear explosions, it goes up very high into the atmosphere and would circle the globe, causing a drop in temperature around the earth, causing crops to fail. And for example, already in the world this year, we have very cool temperatures. Where's the global warming? But at any rate, a small-scale nuclear exchange, and one of the examples was, say, Pakistan and India had a small-scale nuclear exchange of about 20 nuclear warheads. This would be sufficient to cause a cooling of the earth, cause crop failures, and the estimate is that most of the people on earth would die of starvation. And so small-scale nuclear wars are not a good idea. So the hope was to convince politicians. In fact, why do politicians have control of weapons like this and using them possibly for political or nationalistic gains? It's absolutely ridiculous. But the point is, small-scale nuclear wars are not a good idea for the entire planet because of the planetary wide-scale cooling that would occur. And so anyway, just wanted to mention that. There will probably be a lot more on that issue in the news. Just wanted to make you aware of that so you keep your ears and eyes open for that particular topic. And then the people who've done this analysis would be presenting that. I'm just bringing this up so that you are aware of this ongoing, these studies that are going on by scientists, and the fact that they're trying to make the world aware of this. And as I say, those people will be presenting their information, and hopefully it will be getting national and international news coverage. Just a quick topic, the Mars Phoenix lander landed on Mars and, of course, has been scooping up material, and they're looking at it. I think that's wonderful, but the only thing I want to mention is that this is what the public gets to see. I find it very hard to believe that that's all that's going on the planet Mars. In fact, I guarantee you there's a great deal of work going on Mars that none of us ever see, but we're all paying for. So at any rate, that is where the secret societies come in. If you want a good glimpse into the workings of the secret societies, in one of the first books that really brought this to light and where they come from in the scientific connection to the past, the ancient past, that this type of information, scientific information or understanding of possible civilizations, for example, on Mars that were coincident with ancient civilizations on Earth, this is information that those groups deem private information, and it's not for the public consumption. So at any rate, just want to mention that there is a lot of activity going on the planet Mars, but nothing that you're going to see in the newspaper or on the websites that purport to be reporting the scientific news. Okay, just a quick comment also on pollution, overpopulation, and the economy that is, of course, is being, the United States is being dragged down to sub-third world level. And, of course, this is attributable to one specific cause. It's called compound interest. About 80% of everybody's resources, including the use of large amounts of energy, are being used to pay interest on loans, on the federal debt. So anybody that is privy to the real workings of the world knows that in the United States, the Federal Reserve is the enemy. It is the cause of 80% of the use of overuse of fuel, energy, and human effort. So, interestingly enough, a guy named John Kennedy, when he was president, signed an executive order on June 4th, 1963, to get rid of the Federal Reserve and to reinstate the monetary system that was designated by the original Congressional Congress, so that the Congress would be in charge of the purse strings and our own treasury would be in charge of our money, not a European banking system. So once again, the Federal Reserve is the enemy. That's about as simply as I can put it. And just along that same line, as long as we're just getting out of a bit of a political quandary in this country, in the United States, it appeared to me, just a quick political comment, that politics in this country are becoming more like a college fraternity or sorority popularity contest than a political campaign. People like, oh, I like this person or whatever. It's really, I would put it on the level with a college sorority or fraternity popularity contest. That is the level of and mentality of the politics going on in the United States, having nothing, absolutely nothing to do with solutions to the problems that are going on in this country and in the world today. So at any rate, and I also want to make a comment because, as I've said before, if information is not coming out in the mainstream media, then I will include it on this show. And around January or February of this year, somewhere in that time frame, it was very clear that the large-scale planners of the world cut the strings to the Clintons. And prior to that, they were kind of the designated next presidential family to occupy the White House. And at one point, they cut the strings, and it was very clear when the money dried up, when Bill Clinton blew up at that superdelegate meeting in California, I said, wait a minute, this is not the way these people normally operate. They have things done behind the scenes. Nobody could figure out where Hillary had $95 million, way more money than all the rest of the candidates put together to begin the political campaign season. And all of a sudden, all that money dried up, and they were spending their own saving. And, of course, nobody can really figure out where that came from either, but be that as it may, they were spending their own money and time and influence trying to sustain the campaign. So it was very clear what the point I'm trying to make is that the big guys cut the leash, so to speak, to the Clintons. And the main reason, obviously, is they finally figured out that Hillary Clinton was for Hillary Clinton, not for them. And it has nothing to do with the country or people voting. It has to do with them paying homage to the people up the ladder. And when you have someone like that that is for themselves, then they are not a team player, if you understand what I mean. Now, the difference is that Billy was a team player. He knew how to play the game, and he did what was right for the team. So Bill was a very different guy, but Hillary was for Hillary. And even the big guys had to cut her loose. Anyway, that's the political analysis you won't hear on the evening news. Just a quick comment before going into the main science topic. I've moved to the Dalton line of water filters, and I just want to give a brief history. I'll have more of this on my webpage, that the Dalton water filter was the very first water filter made in the mid-1800s, and people were getting sick in England as they were living along the river, the Thames River, etc. And a guy named Dalton put together the first ceramic water filter and was able to clean up the water so people could drink it without getting sick. And so anyway, that became that filter system, the one that is still used today, the same recipe, so to speak. That's why I went to the Dalton filter when it became clear that there was some inability to get products in the water filter industry. I had to go out and find something, and so I went to the best, oldest company in the world. And by the way, it's as I say, this, I'm not going to spend a lot more time on this on my show, but the thing I had to do was to provide continuity with the people who had already purchased products from me, and to provide a new, very solid company that had been around and would be around for a long time into the future. And as most of you know, to introduce the Dalton line, I used a promotion on my webpage for the small personal water filter. And that was listed as $79.95. I have been remiss in getting my webpage updated, and that price will go up. It was supposed to go up last Saturday, but I've been just behind on all my personal work here. But for mail order, because I never really got to properly announce this on the radio for all those people out there who don't have internet and who order by mail, I will, just for mail order only, I'll keep the $79.95 price for the personal water filter. This is a stainless steel 1 liter water filter. It has one filter element in it. It was designed for special operations, military use, for the personal water filter for people on operations. And so these have been made, and I have an exclusive on these. So they're only available through my website or by mail order. So for those people who use mail order, you can still get this into the future, $79.95 plus shipping. And I would, just to be safe, for the 50 states, add $10, and that will cover shipping. So once again, it's 3.5 inches in diameter, 7 inches high. And then when you stack it folds together. When you open it up, it's about 10 inches high. and it filters 1 liter of water in about an hour. As I said, this was made for special operations, military use, for private water filter, and they are excellent. Plus, of course, I have the full-size Dalton water filter with two elements, plus the two spare Dalton water filter elements, and free shipping to the 50 states. That's for $319. So for people who are using mail order, I would suggest getting and as I said before, the people who purchase the black water filter systems, the black filter elements, those are compatible. So if in the future you ever have to replace those, and by the way, that's why I've always insisted that people buy these systems with four water filters, two that you use now and two spares for later or for emergency, because in this world that we live in today, you never know what's going to happen or when you might not be able to get other replacement parts and that type of thing. That's why I always sell these with four filters, two to use now and two to use later. And for anybody who has the black filters, they are compatible with the white replacement filters, and you can upgrade to the white filters at any time in the future, and they'll fit in your current system. So onwards to the main science topic. And right now I have two releases that are coming next week. I'll have a major release that I'll announce on the radio show. And this week is kind of a mini release. The scientific meeting that I just attended, I created a poster, and so this is a new addition to the posters on my webpage. And so I'll read from this poster tonight, and this will be available on the webpage, the web ordering page, probably by morning. And it'll be a beautiful poster. It's a gorgeous poster. The one that you can purchase will be about 2 feet high by about 3 feet wide. And as I said, I'll be covering that. And then next week, on next week's radio show, I will have the next major release ready to roll out to the public. So stay tuned for that. So the mini release this week is a poster, and I'll go through that this evening. The first thing, I just want to make a couple quick comments before I go into this. We have a problem on Earth, and that is one of not so much overpopulation. We have a problem of mismanagement of resources. And we have countries like the United States, which are vastly overusing energy, as I said, primarily to pay for interest on debt. And it's breaking down. The system is very much breaking down. And you have the Federal Reserve with their finger up their nose, literally, unable to do anything. And the whole idea is to bring down the United States financially. This is a plan. This is not ineptness. This is a plan that's being implemented. So the basic situation is the people on this planet have to stop following this insane plan. They have to start living according to their means, which means basically stopping the 40-hour work week, this insane driving in rush hour traffic every day in every city of this country. Burning up all of this energy just to pay interest is absolutely insane, and it has to stop. So at any rate, the concept that everybody needs a good job, it used to work, but it doesn't work anymore. So now I'm going to turn to the poster, and I'm going to go through these topics, and one by one. Whenever you have a presentation at a scientific meeting like this, you typically start out with a summary, or an abstract, as it's called. And so I'm just going to read a couple of the lines from the abstract to get you somewhat up to speed with what this is about. The topic is sources of EMF in near-Earth and planetary environments. I'll read that again. Sources of EMF in near-Earth and planetary environments. Now, EMF, what is that? electromagnetic fields, EMF. That's an abbreviation used commonly in physics. So the whole idea is that the energy that we see, the electrical energy that affects our weather system, that causes the auroras, that drives the cyclonic storms, the hurricanes, the tornadoes, that creates the elves and sprites and other phenomenon above cloud systems, the noctiluminescent clouds, for example, those beautiful hazy clouds that sometimes you can see at sundown, where the upper atmosphere is actually illuminated by some energetic electrical phenomenon. All of these have the same source of energy. For example, I have a picture of the Chaitén volcanoes in Chile with the extreme amount of electrical activity coming out of the clouds and the ash plume down to the ground as this amazing volcanic eruption occurs. And then also I have a picture of the ocean floor surrounding the Caribbean, showing how hurricanes are actually controlled. Their paths are affected by the underwater topography. So let me start reading from this poster, and then I'll go into some detail on all of the various topics here. So once again, the title, Sources of EMF in Near-Earth and Planetary Environments. So this is not limited to Earth. This is includes all of the planets. And this is a very complex topic because you have planets with no magnetic field, like Venus, and then you have planets with immense magnetic fields, like Jupiter. And the solar wind, the other electrical activities are very much altered and modified by these massive electric and magnetic fields around the planets. In fact, in some cases, they are driven by the solar wind and these extra planetary electric fields that are basically driven by the sun. Now, many of you have my Planet X Comets and Earth Changes book, and in there I have a picture of the Eskimo Nebula. It's something that I had in my original publications back in 1979 as an indication of a star system with a surrounding capacitor, and that's the best way to describe it. You have an excess current of protons in the solar wind, something that scientists really have never been able to grasp because their fundamental belief is that space is electrically neutral. And so they have many reasons for thinking that, including satellite measurements. Now, if you take a satellite in outer space, you cannot measure electric potentials any more than you could take a single wire from a voltmeter and measure the electrical potential of a battery in your car. You need two test points. You need a voltage is relative to one point and point A and point B. The voltage is relative to those two points. So if you only have a single spacecraft, you don't have point B, so to speak. And so how can you possibly measure a voltage or a potential, an electrical potential in outer space? You absolutely cannot. But that's what scientists have been trying to do. And, of course, misguiding much of our resources and finances and building spacecraft that simply are not working properly because they don't understand the principles of spacecraft charging, of electrical conditions in the solar system, and how can they possibly measure and detect and then interpret data if they don't understand that the very spacecraft they're using is becoming charged and interacting with an electrical environment which they don't even believe is there. So it's an amazing set of conundrums that the scientific world is facing. But as I said, now the Tier 1 groups are starting to, these are the groups that deal with reality, and they're starting to understand that these issues exist. And believe me, they want to know reality. They're not worried about some NASA scientist's theoretical view of the world based on 1950s concepts. These guys want to know reality. And they're putting a lot of money up there, and if they're getting bad information from the standard scientific community, they certainly want to know about it. So at any rate, it's a new twist on an old topic, but as with, for example, in the Middle Ages, they had to deal with reality. They had to build ships. They had to get to locations. They had to navigate. They needed clocks. They needed all kinds of things that never had to come out of the scientific industry. They had to deal with effects like Coriolis forces due to the spinning of the Earth. They had to deal with reality. And so when people are putting their money, their hard-earned money and investment into the rules of the game change. And the NASA scientists, with their little theories, don't really cut it anymore because they're not dealing with reality. They could deal with their publications. They could deal with their journals, so-called respectable journals, and that could go on for decades and decades as it has done. But eventually, they're going to get squeezed out the side of the picture because people are going to realize that they're still talking about dirty snowballs over there when everybody over here knows that, in fact, comets are not dirty snowballs, never have been, never will be. So those people still get their funding, they still get their paycheck, they can still talk a little bit about dirty snowballs, but nobody's listening to them because now you have groups that have to deal with reality. So let me go on with the poster. Reading the next line, all fusion-based stellar objects emit an excess current of protons in the fusion-supported wind that emanates from the central fusion object. Now, that sounds like a mouthful, but I bet you that 90% of the people listening to my radio show have somewhat or at least a clear understanding of what that means. That means there is an excess of protons in the wind that comes off the fusion-based star. And that creates the capacitor. And the example that I always use, very commonplace example, is the backyard bug killer. There's a set of screen meshes that are separated by a distance. There's air in between, and when the bug flies in between the screens, an electrical discharge occurs, and it always zaps in the location of the bug. And that's the same situation anytime you have something, an object, a planet, a moon, a spacecraft, or even a dust particle, in that capacitor, it will discharge the capacitor in the local environment. And so that's what this is all about. Planets, including the Earth and our moon, are immersed in the electric field that surrounds the star we call our sun. So the main driving force of the auroras, of the noctoluminescent clouds, of the elves and sprites above thunderstorms, of the lightning that comes out of the thunderstorm down to ground, the same source of electromagnetic field is driven by the solar wind, which has an excess current of protons. So that's the basic fundamental concept from which everything flows. From that point on, it's just basic physics. You take an object in the solar system, so a lot of this, actually a lot of the information here comes from my original work back in the early 1980s, going back to 1979. Now let's talk about a spacecraft in outer space. Let's say it's around Earth, and let's say it's trying to go to the moon. It's moving between the Van Allen belts. Here's a near-Earth object. It's an artificial satellite, might contain people. And around Earth, you have belts. You have protons moving one way. You have electrons moving the other way in very high-energy belts of charge that move around the Earth. These are extremely high-energy particles trapped in the radiation belt, basically the magnetic field of Earth. And as a spacecraft tries to move through those, it will experience a certain amount of impact from these charged particles. But there's something else very subtle that happens. as the spacecraft moves between the rings of protons and the ring of protons and the ring of electrons, it starts to discharge like a large battery. Now, this can cause a little bit of problem, because once these discharges start to flow, it's much like the discharge from the ionosphere to ground that drives a hurricane. It's much like the discharge from the ionosphere to ground that would drive a Tesla tower. Once these flow patterns begin, it is extremely difficult to stop them. That's where the problem comes in, and that's why it's very difficult to move out into regions of outer space with manned spacecraft. You might remember back in the 1980s, they sent some space shuttle missions up into relatively low Earth orbit, but about a 500-kilometer altitude, and the astronauts' eyebrows began to glow. And they couldn't figure out why, but they brought them back down, and they've really never gone there since. Well, and that's what I'm talking about. Any object in that region is going to start to discharge those localized capacitors. So one of the main points of my presentation that past week, and once again, this is from my work that goes far back into my early work, was to show that these localized batteries are all around the Earth. In fact, I've identified 17 of them, and those I've listed 8 of them on this particular presentation, just to give people an idea of where the localized batteries are. Now, add to this the Moon. The Moon moves outside of Earth's magnetic field for part of its orbit. It moves back into the Earth's tail, which is basically a comet tail. It's called the magnetic tail, but it's basically a flow of energy that's passing by Earth based on the solar wind. And then, as we see right now in June 3rd, the new moon, the moon sits out between Earth and the sun, and as it moves out of the way, from between the Earth and the Sun, as the Moon moves away, the solar wind, which it was blocking, now comes pounding in, compresses Earth's magnetic field, and drives the storm systems that we are seeing today. All of this is very understandable if you are in a government program that is responsible for spacecraft safety, or you're responsible for future missions where you're designing spacecraft or other any type of vehicle that might be moving between the atmosphere and outer space. You have to understand these, and additionally you have to understand how the solar wind and solar storms can affect these. So, for example, when the comet came by the sun on May 23rd, if you were about to launch a spacecraft from Earth's low, from the ground up into the, through the ionosphere and into space, you may want to wait a bit, because that 3-day window when the storms are occurring, for example, on May 26th, that would be a time when you could also have adverse effects on a spacecraft or a rocket or any other type of vehicle going in that transition boundary region of the ionosphere and outer space. So, at any rate, you may recall the space shuttle as it came in. The accident where it came in, and there were pictures of it with electrical activity around it. I posted that a couple days. In fact, I was driving through Texas the day that happened. I remember going into a gas station and looking at the monitors as they showed the traces coming across the television screen of that shuttle breaking up. I was on my way at that time also to a scientific conference to give a talk. And that was in my talk the next day, dealing with the issue that the space shuttle is not the way we should be going into space or coming back out of space. But at any rate, that was a good example where a solar storm was active at that time, and it was not a good plan to bring that spacecraft into the Earth's atmosphere at that specific time. So let me go on to a little bit more of the poster here. I've already talked about the Chaitén volcanoes in Chile. And of course, once again, you're dealing with electromagnetic discharges from the ionosphere. The volcano goes off, the plume goes up, and attaches to the ionosphere electrically. It's like a giant finger sticking up into the air, begins to discharge the Earth's capacitor up to the ionosphere, and then causing a tremendous amount of electrical activity over the volcano. Now, let's talk about auroras, those beautiful electrical displays. I was very impressed, I should say this, with the modeling and the advanced understanding that scientists now have of the aurora phenomenon. Even a few years ago, it was not well understood. It was not well modeled. Measurements were not very good as far as the charged particle movement around the auroras. So this has all come a long ways. And so you have some very good scientists now working around auroral activity, understanding the currents, the electrical potentials, the particle movement, the density of the atmosphere. They have a lot of data and a lot of good modeling. So I have to say this, I was very impressed with the level of knowledge and understanding that has developed just in the last couple years dealing with the phenomena we call aurora, the aurora borealis, the northern lights, and also southern lights, if you live in the southern hemisphere. And of course, this is, if you look, there are many satellites that look down on Earth and can see this ring of light as it glows and fades. It's actually always there, but as this glows and fades on a daily basis, as the Earth spins on its axis and as it goes through the seasons from spring and summer and fall and winter, of course, we have other aspects that affect the aurora. One of the things I should mention that I've talked about many times before is the peak of the aurora season is in the month of August. The hurricane season also peaks in August, and our tornado season also peaks in the month of August. Well, why would that be? Because in this overall vision of the solar system with the solar wind emanating from the central star, there has to be a return current, and guess where that return current comes back to the central star? It's in the region where Earth passes through in the month of August. And I saw a number of other phenomena that are very directly related to the fact that there is a return current sheet to the sun, electrical current sheet, in the direction where Earth is relative to the sun in the month of August. So I'm about out of time. Hopefully I covered the details that of the past 2 weeks. Join me next week as I have a new major release that will come out, and I know you're going to like this. It's something that everybody will be very interested in, and it's historically very timely. So once again, this is Jim McKenney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.